When I was growing up in Arkansas, my mother was a nurse anesthetist. So from an early age, I spent a lot of time in and around hospitals, which led to a lifelong fascination with medicine, science, and public health. That's why, as the COVID-19 pandemic began to unfold, it was so shocking and disheartening to see the way the federal government and many others across our society responded. From the time the first cases of the coronavirus began to be reported here in the U.S. just around this time last year, America found itself in a battle against two interconnected diseases. First, COVID-19, which has now claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and upended the way we work, live, and interact with each other. And the second is a major reason why COVID was able to claim such a devastating toll: the malignant spreading of misinformation and downplaying of the seriousness of the virus. There were people with an ideological agenda telling the public that COVID-19 was far less dangerous than the flu, that different drugs or supplements could effectively treat the virus without any supporting evidence, that social distancing and the use of masks were unnecessary long after the science had shown otherwise, that the number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths were overblown. They even said that the doctors working tirelessly on the front lines and risking their own lives to save patients were inflating numbers for monetary gain. And the list goes on and on. So why am I telling you this? Because you can't effectively confront any health crisis without clear, science-driven information for the public. I'm very grateful the new Biden administration has empowered scientists and public health experts like Dr. Fauci to speak to the American people and guide our response. And I'm very grateful, too, to all those who work so hard to cut through misinformation so that people can stay informed and keep themselves and their families and neighbors safe. And that's why I'm glad to have someone with me today who's been one of America's most trusted medical sources for decades, and especially over the last year, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. As CNN's chief medical correspondent and an associate professor of neurosurgery at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, throughout the pandemic, Sanjay's dispatches have given practical tips for staying healthy and built trust in science and medicine, including recently taking the COVID-19 vaccine on camera to prove its safety. He's also a prolific author whose new book, Keep Sharp, is full of ways to improve brain health, something I have always been interested in and at the age of 74 am now virtually obsessed by it. So, Sanjay, thanks for being here today.
What an honor, Mr. President. So delighted to be with you. I can see you. The listeners cannot. You look fantastic. I'll just throw that in there as well.
Well, I'm trying to follow the advice in your book. We're nearly a year into the pandemic. What a year ago seemed to be concentrated in New York and Washington State and California has now spread across the country. And it's still claiming a couple of thousand of our citizens every day. So briefly, tell us in broad strokes, where are we now? What should someone listening know and do as we continue to navigate and hope for a time of return to a more normal life?
When I first started reporting on this, there was all these models we would look at, and I always sort of picked a mid-range model to share with the public as part of our reports. You know, I justified it by looking at all the various factors. Didn't want to give the best case scenario because that didn't look like it was going to happen based on what we were seeing initially, but the worst case scenario was really frightening. Over the last couple of weeks, we have surpassed the worst case scenario model. And I'm even careful in how I want to give that information to the public. Who, I mean, what value does it serve? But the truth is that that is the case, that even if you looked at all the worst case models, we're past those. So it's pretty dark days. There is going to be a peak, and then we will come out the backside of this curve. The question is, how high will be that peak and how long will we stay there? How long will we plateau there? And what's happening right now will dictate that. And that's all human behavior. The other thing I will say is that the vaccines are incredible. They really are. Can I just tell you the story? Because you probably know the story, but I am so blown away by this story, and I think it's also one of the brightest spots in this pandemic. Just 3 or 4 days after the genetic code for this virus was shared with the world, just a couple days after that, the vaccine platforms were set. I mean, the amount of scientific development, these were guys who took a code and were writing down their platform on the back of napkins and sharing it with other scientists and doing this over, you know, over Zoom calls because people were talking all over the world. They came up with the vaccine platform really fast. And 2 months after that genetic code was initially shared, trials were started. Shots were going into arms. So it's an incredible, incredible story of medical innovation. And I just, you know, it's been so few things to celebrate, I'll be honest with you, Mr. President, that I maybe get particularly excited about this. But there are diseases that you well know. I mean, HIV, AIDS, 40 years been trying to get a vaccine, and we don't have one. To have two authorized vaccines within a year, by the end of 2020, was truly a remarkable thing. And I think, frankly, probably has changed medical innovation forever, not just around pandemics, but just forever. What we were able to do with our backs up against the wall, the system doesn't get pressured like that very often. During times of conflict, yes, a pandemic, some of our greatest medical achievements come about during these very dire circumstances. And that was the case here as well.
A lot of just ordinary citizens do wonder if there is any chance, however remote, that taking this vaccine could alter their DNA. And the answer to that is no. But why don't you explain to them why? Why can't it alter my DNA?
It is a genetic-based vaccine, but it's a messenger RNA. This isn't sort of the blueprint for anything that would come in there and basically compete with your own blueprint. And if I can, Mr. President, just on the healthcare workers, so many healthcare workers who are not getting vaccinated as well have a distrust of the entire system because many of them who may be black or brown healthcare workers have seen some of these vaccine trials in the past. They've seen other medical trials that have been outright discriminatory. And I think there is a real longstanding hangover effect from that. So I think that's driving a lot of vaccine hesitancy among African-Americans, among Latinos as well. We've seen that. And there's been these incredible outreach campaigns at like Morehouse School of Medicine. And you've had people come and lead vaccination campaigns. But I do think that that's driving it. And that's been another theme we've seen throughout this pandemic, these disparities based on history.
But this time there was an effort to make sure we had a diverse pool of people on whom the vaccine was tested.
Absolutely. There was two really interesting things. There was a commitment to really getting that the trial participants to represent the burden of this disease, right? It wasn't just saying, hey, there's 12% African Americans, is this percent this, and let's do that in the trial. It's like, who did this disease burden? We should have that be representative in the percentage of trial participants. And then just about every step of the way in terms of the vaccine development, from the basic scientists. There's a 34-year-old woman working at the NIH named Kizzy Corbett who, first of all, she's 34 years old. So regardless of anything else, it's incredible that she is at the forefront of developing a vaccine in the middle of a pandemic. She's a black woman. I've interviewed her, you know, several times. So impressive, and had these incredible ideas about how to really make this mRNA vaccine work. But you had all these scientists every step of the way who've been part of the process as well, who are African-American, who are Latino. But there's still hesitancy, Mr. President. There's still this hesitancy that exists. It's improved, but it's definitely out there.
You know, Francis Collins, he was there with me when I was president when we first sequenced the human genome. He is a very devout Christian, and he wrote a book about reconciling his faith with his scientific endeavors about 3 years ago. And I just went back and reread it just because maybe we need to learn to speak to people for whom religion is a factor in all this. In a different way. And then there are those for whom it is, as you said, just politics, who believe if some talk show host says something that, because I agree with him politically, that they're all of a sudden, by definition, a greater authority than Sanjay Gupta. I think that's absurd, and that's going to take longer to fix. But we got to figure out a solution to this. I mean, I was thinking about these healthcare workers. 30% of our healthcare workforce has declined to take the vaccine. When Governor Cuomo, when New York was hit so hard, sent out a call, you know, for, I can't remember, 100,000 or something, retired healthcare workers and others to come help. 30,000 people came from other states to New York and risked their lives. And then all these volunteers, people who were in vulnerable age groups themselves, came back. And to think that they are now afraid, some of them, to accept the fruits of their labor, their sacrifice, trying to keep people alive. It's really troubling to me.
One of the things that I was so, at the beginning of the pandemic, so heartened by, you remember it was 7 o'clock every night, you'd hear people banging on their pots and pans and screaming, and
yep.
People would pull the sirens, you know, and just, it was a very celebratory thing. And they were celebrating healthcare workers. And I love that. And that was, you know, spring of 2020. And now, Mr. President, I mean, things have changed. And what has changed is that those same healthcare workers, some of them get threatened, you know, for wearing a mask. They get in arguments with people. I mean, it's really incredible to me that within this time period, just how much our attitudes have shifted towards healthcare workers, these heroes, these people who we really wanted to celebrate. And now, you know, they're just these bearers of bad news who no one wants to really hear from. It's a real cognitive, you know, dissonance, I think, for healthcare workers. I was in the hospital the other day. I'm still practicing, and I was up on the COVID unit. I'm a neurosurgeon, so I'm not directly taking care of COVID patients, but sometimes my patients will end up on the COVID unit because they get diagnosed with COVID. And I was up there, and you've seen some of these images, I'm sure, Mr. President, these COVID units. But first of all, they're jam-packed. Sometimes ICUs have a couple extra beds. You're finding space wherever you can find them. And they do this thing called proning the patient. You may have heard, it basically means instead of lying on your back, you're lying on your stomach. And they do this because they found that it made it a lot easier for people with COVID to breathe. But they got to then strap the patient in with these belts and these sheets and everything. And the patient's not the most comfortable. But then sometimes they'd bring in these iPads and the person would be talking to their family. And sometimes they'd be saying goodbye. And that was true. I mean, I'm not trying to paint that. I saw this. So proning patients, looking at iPads, and I would see this. And then I would go home in my car, drive by the gas station, and I'm filling my gas and I have my mask on, and some guys give me a funny look, like, hey, you know, what's up with the mask sort of thing. It was whiplash. I just saw a guy saying goodbye to his family on his iPad, and, you know, he's around my age, and now some guy who's also around my age is giving me a hard time about wearing a mask. That was happening, like, you know, throughout this pandemic, I think, for a lot of healthcare workers. How can you not take this seriously if you can only see what I am seeing?
What's your take on what we should do now and in the future, even as the, hopefully, knock on wood, the threat of coronavirus becomes more manageable and then recedes, to restore faith in basic scientific information? It's really hard for me to talk to people because it's not like, you know, the people that do this science work, it's their lives. They're dedicated. They're good people. They have no interest in failing. Nobody can ever give me a motive for why people would try to do something that's dishonest. It seems so irrational. What do you think we should do going forward to try to shift this in our country, even if it's a slow process?
You know, I think we can always do a better job at messaging. You know, I think some of the back and forth, for example, at the beginning on masks, I think we're, you know, left people confused about things. Even talking about the vaccines, you know, being very careful and specific in how we phrase things, a genetic vaccine, but here's what that means, you know, that sort of stuff, anticipating, you know, people's concerns as opposed to ignoring or even demeaning them, which is why I think the arrogance sort of thing comes in. But the biggest thing, I think, Mr. President, is that it just, I think there's certain places in our society that just have to be the honest brokers. They cannot be entangled with politics at all in this regard. They have to be boring, disentangled sort of institutions. And I think doctors, as a general rule, you know, people who are providing direct care to patients do that. They look, I'm not always going to tell you what you want to hear, but you know that I'm being 100% honest with you, and I only have your best interests in mind. Who are those people in our society? Scientists, I think, you know, and doctors, you know, have held that role in many, and there's others as well, not just them, but I'm saying that they've had that role. But once this process became so entangled politically, I think that's the major thing, that you have to avoid that at all costs.
People need to understand that the whole, I think if they understood the scientific method better, that knowledge, practical knowledge that human beings use is always evolving. And we may see facts today which seem to be right, but a new paradigm could take over tomorrow or 10 years from now or 20 years from now. But the way humanity progresses is in these logical steps, which means you always have to be prepared to admit you're wrong. We have too many people in America today who believe that if they ever have to admit they're wrong, they'll vanish and go away. They won't exist anymore.
Right.
You know, and I think we have to get more comfortable with that. We need to, it's now seen as political betrayal or professional suicide. And I think that the whole business of science sees error as your friend. And life is much more like science, or should be, a healthy life, than it is about dreading error and claiming infallibility. Somehow we have to, there's a psychological key we have to unlock here, I think.
I think what you said is so right. I think that in med school and residency training, this idea that you have to fail in order to learn, it's almost more like Battleship. Like, I'm going to zero in on the exact right thing, but I have to make a bunch of attempts to get there, is sort of part of the culture. But you're right. I think in many parts of our society, it's really hard to if you admit failure, have you lost trust? Or is the public no longer going to trust you as much? And if you're a scientist, that matters. So it makes it a very difficult situation.
Science is a process, and you don't become smaller by acknowledging error. You become bigger, and you grow more. Somehow we got to get comfortable with that again.
Yeah, do you think it's a pendulum swing, Mr. President? I mean, has this been a trajectory where we're less and less comfortable with admitting error?
Oh, sure. Look, what brought on the Age of Reason centuries ago was in no small measure a reaction to institutions and individuals that claimed infallibility and made decisions which had disastrous results. So human reason, the effort to think things through and work with others who were thinking things through and then debate with people who disagreed with you as you thought things through, we all believed it would lead to something better. Then over time, over many centuries, most self-governing institutions have ultimately failed because of they lack the individual and collective discipline to deal with thorny problems and disappointment and the darker sides of human nature in terms of discrimination and fear of failure. Right. So it's a process. You just have to keep going. Stay tuned for more of the conversation after this short break. So let me ask, let's shift a minute to your new book, because before we started the conversation formally, I told you, you know, I've reached the age now where building a better brain at any age, it may seem like a pipe dream, but it's a beautiful one to me. And I don't know how long I'm going to live. I'm blessed. I'm already the oldest man in my family for three generations. But however long I live, I'd like to hold on to my marbles as long as I can. And you've written a book for people really of all ages about that. Can you briefly summarize what you think is the most important thing to do in maintaining and improving the way your brain works?
Absolutely. This starts with a premise that the neuroscience community has known for some time, and the public is now catching up. And that's part of what inspired me to write the book. And that is that I think for a long time, the widely held belief was that when it came to your brain, when it came to neurons in your brain cells, you had a certain cache of these cells, and they slowly drained sort of as life went on, wear and tear, kind of like you see in other organs and other body systems and things like that. There was only two times in your life when you could actually grow new brain cells, according to previously conventional wisdom. That was when you were a baby and developing, you know, still, and then also after a particular injury, like a stroke or a traumatic brain injury. Your brain might be stimulated to grow new brain cells then. That was it. That was the belief. What we've learned over the last 10 years is that throughout your entire life, you can go through the process of what's called neurogenesis, which is basically the growth of new brain cells. That can happen throughout your entire life. That may sound like a simple statement, but that was very transformative in the world of neuroscience. So if it happening, you're actually growing new brain cells throughout your life, the next obvious question was how do you do it? You know, what do you do? And that was the real journey. So I'll tell you some of the things that I learned, and also preface by saying there are places around the world where rates of dementia are a small fraction of what they are here in the United States. And by the way, they typically have lower rates of heart disease and diabetes and things like that as well. That is true. We are all humans, and yet because of where they live, how they live, things like that, they have a fraction of these diseases that so plague us in this country. So the idea that the lifestyle had something to do with it was widely accepted. It wasn't just going to be therapeutics and medicines. These people who had much lower rates of disease weren't taking any therapeutics and medicines. They just had lower rates. The way I sort of approached it was to say, here's the five pillars of how we live, how we move, how we eat, how we rest, how we develop connections, how we find purpose in our lives, and then basically scientifically validate, deconstruct one's life and say, here are the best evidence-based things you should be doing if you want to have a sharp brain now, if you want to develop this process of neurogenesis, and you want to protect your brain later. That's how I sort of approached it. And the evidence is incredible. You know, the evidence has been there. In some ways, I just acted as a translator, you know, between the neuroscience research that's magnificent and wonderful and what the public wants to know.
What you're basically saying is exercise, appropriate rest, appropriate diet, and then having social connections and a purpose beyond yourself. Those things are the five most important things.
One thing I will say is I avoided using certain words in the book. I don't know if you noticed. Exercise is not a word I use very often. I use the word movement. And I found that in many of these places that I was describing where they don't have very high rates of dementia at all, there was something else they often didn't have, and that was gyms. I got nothing against gyms, but my point is that going to the gym wasn't really the point. The idea of sitting or lying for 23 hours a day and then going to the gym for an hour a day wasn't really the point. That's not how human beings were designed. So it was really all about movement. It was less of thinking of activity as the cure and more like thinking of inactivity as the disease. Just don't be inactive. If you're about to sit, ask, can I be standing instead? If you're about to, you know, do something that's highly convenient, can I take a few steps instead? It's a way of life. It's in fact, they found in these studies, and my mom loved this part, but they said the intense exercise actually could be actually counterproductive. Because in addition to releasing all these wonderful, when you move, you're releasing these neurotrophic factors for the brain. It's like Miracle-Gro for the brain. That was a direct quote from a very prominent neuroscientist, in case anyone bristles at that. Miracle-Gro for the brain. You get that from your movement, and there's plenty of evidence behind this. But if you intensely ran, you were also releasing cortisol and other stress hormones, which might actually be counterproductive. So if it's your brain you're trying to move for, then a brisk walk is far better than an intense run, which, again, maybe some people know this. I don't think a lot of people do. They think the harder and faster, the better. Not necessarily when it comes to the brain. So, yeah, exercise. But if you want to talk about your brain, here's the best way to think about exercise.
Well, let me ask you another related question. Are there any exciting neuroscience developments in terms of brain repair?
One of the things I've learned, even in just writing this book, and I want to answer your question, but one of the things I've learned is that we do take a lot of things as preordained as part of aging. We just sort of accept it. Oh, that's just me getting older. And I just keep coming back to these stories, of people that I've met around the world who, you know, live in these other cultures. Who I met this guy when I was in, I lived in the rainforest for part of the story I was doing a few years ago in the Bolivian rainforest, the Amazon. And I was visiting with this group of this tribe called the Chimane indigenous tribe. And I wanted to visit with them because they had hardly any issues with heart disease. And I was very interested in heart disease. As you know, you and I have spent some time talking about heart disease in the past. And when I got there, met up with these men who I couldn't tell how old they were. And it was fun to ask them how old they were. And we were having double translation because it was Spanish to Chimane and then back Chimane to Spanish to English. And they basically said to me, they didn't know how old they were, but they had been born and they would die. And they were simply in that in-between time right now. That's how they described their age. But one of the guys took me fishing, and we guessed, based on various things, that he was probably in his mid to late 70s. He took me fishing. We got on this little rowboat, and he took off his shirt, and he was really buff, for a guy in his mid to late 70s. It was kind of incredible. And then he perched on the side of the boat, so 1 foot on one side of the boat, and it was a small little rowboat, and he was balanced there, and he was crouched down, and he was spear fishing. And his balance was perfect. And he had no eyeglasses on. And he was listening to this guy very faintly calling out on the shore about where the fish were. And he was trying to spear them. Hearing, sight, everything. Now, I'm not saying everybody is like that. All I'm saying is that it's possible. It is possible. It is not preordained for us to have this gradual wear and tear phenomenon that our senses become increasingly blunted as we get old. It's not preordained that we lose our memories and all that sort of stuff. But we do count on science too. There's incredible work going on with trying to regenerate new parts of the brain, also teach other parts of the brain how to take over function. If someone has lost function after a head injury or something like that, or a stroke, that's neuroplasticity. So those hearing neurons are not going to be responsible for sight. I'm making that up, but I'm saying that you get that sort of recruitment within the brain that's happening, and that's pretty fascinating overall research that's happening. They're still doing a lot with stem cell research. Something that you've known quite a bit about, and and we're talking early 90s and some of the work that you first helped fund, that's ongoing. And some of it's being used for things like ALS research and still diabetes research, which is, I think, one of the first things that really interested you in some of the stem cell work. Yep. It's all ongoing. And it's fascinating. Things that have changed neuroscience in transformative ways are airbags and seatbelts, because head injuries have dramatically been reduced as a result of that. So, we have all these sort of colliding factors when it comes to how neuroscience is going to continue its upward trajectory.
We'll be right back. You had some interesting stuff in your book about how, well, doing crossword puzzles or math problems or Sudoku or whatever, that's interesting, but it's better for your brain health if you have diverse contacts.
Right.
And every day, Hillary and I do this bumblebee word puzzle in the New York Times.
I know.
And what we do is we do it on our own, then we meet. And I do it in part because we have about the same levels of education and size, vocabulary, you know, and we see reality different. I mean, here's someone I'm so close to, but like if a puzzle, let's say, has got 60 words, there are times when I've had as many as 5 words she didn't, and she's had as 5 or 6 I didn't. And it's fascinating to me, just as a lesson in perception, much less we're not getting into psychology and feeling and all that, that E.O. Wilson, the great microbiologist, first made this impression on me. But he said, you know, diverse groups make better decisions than homogenous ones or lone geniuses. And Wilson's 90 and sounds like he's 40. So, you know, I do believe that we need to keep striving for human connection as long as we live, and we're more likely to keep vigorous and alert and relevant if we do.
Well, you know, no surprise, Mr. President, you've taken it a step further even than I had considered in my book. I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, I think in some ways, what I was trying to get at in the book was that we are not nearly optimized enough when it comes to our brains. And I'm talking about individuals here. I want to comment on what you just said about the collective, because I think that's so interesting. But the idea that individuals are not yet optimized to be the best contributors to the collective, I think is also true. And in large part, it's because we didn't think we could do it. Right. I think with the heart, okay, yeah, I'll run, you know, do this and I'll eat this kind of diet. And that was, I'll keep my cholesterol below a certain amount. All that sort of stuff was very true. With the brain, it was like, it's in this black box, right? I can't even see it. It's immutable. It's untouchable. It's impenetrable. It is a black box measured only by its inputs and its outputs. I don't even know how to measure it. And so how do I change it, right? In medicine, things are more important because they are measurable, which makes no sense. Why are you more important because I can measure you? There's things that are really important. I just can't quite, I have no context to give you a measure of that. And therefore we ignore it. And I think that was been true of the brain for a long time. So most people didn't even try to optimize their brains. And you find that in such simple ways, you can dramatically improve your brain function. And I'm not talking about memorizing a list of 10 disparate words, because that has no real relevance for memory. Memory exists to serve you. Yes, it'll tell you that an oven's hot and a tiger can bite and all that sort of stuff, but it mostly is just your life narrative. It's the story of us, story of you. And so it's totally changeable, totally malleable. Based on an experience you had today, a memory from 2 days ago will change. And that's okay. That's how memory works, and that's how it's supposed to work. It's only there to serve you. And I think that once you understand that, and you understand that you can optimize your brain in pretty simple ways, then I can dramatically improve people's level of sharpness. I use that word, you know, colloquially, but, you know, their overall brain function now, I can improve that, I think, with this, but also help protect that same brain for later. So that I think is the crux of it. And then all those people can add to a better collective, as you were describing, a diverse collective that will generate knowledge for a society.
A few years ago, I read a report of a study in one of the medical journals that said we can form new neural networks in the brains at much greater ages than we previously thought. And it said that basically the most important thing you could do is something new. So that if, let's say, you had made a career as a physicist, instead of taking one last stab at, you know, finding the answers to the unified theory, which requires a massive amount of brain power and knowledge, that a person in his or her 60s or older would be better off going with their grandchild a Suzuki piano if they'd never played a piano before. And do you agree with that doing different things makes a bigger difference?
Absolutely. This idea that just doing something new is building new roads in your brain. This is the thing, Mr. President. Our brains right now in some ways are operating like our COVID lives are operating. At the house, you may know how to get directly to the foundation, to the office, to the grocery store. You know, you could do that stuff with your eyes closed. You're really good at it. That's no problem. And that's great as long as all those roads and those buildings stay open and everything. But if you start to build new roads in your brain by doing some of these things, you have new roads in your brain, which is kind of fun because you can go take a drive and you'll see patterns that you may have otherwise missed because, you know, you have this new destinations. But also, if the road that you're used to traveling does become blocked or has some construction needed because of an amyloid plaque, you've got 10 other roads now to choose from. So someone who develops dementia later in life on their brain scans, that person looks like they have dementia, may not have any cognitive symptoms because they've built up all this cognitive reserve. That's the beauty of the neurogenesis. And building a new road, I mean, I know you're left-handed, Mr. President. Tonight, when you have dinner, try eating with your right hand instead of your left. Just eat the entire meal with your right hand being the dominant one. And you'll see things change. First of all, it's going to be a lot harder than you realize. And you're so used to eating, putting a fork to your mouth, cutting with your knife. Try flipping it. If you tie your shoes, try flipping the loops the other way. You know, you have to visualize that, but just little things like that. Get outside your comfort zone a little bit. Do something that scares you is one of the adages that a neuroscientist told me. And you're building new roads in your brain. And it's fun. And it makes you happy. And it helps protect your brain later on. That's what I think is so exciting.
Well, that's given me something to think about. Let's close by coming back to COVID just a moment. I personally believe that reluctance to take the vaccine will go down dramatically as evidence of its working goes up and as more people's friends and neighbors do it. But tell people why it's important to keep wearing their masks even after they've been vaccinated.
This is a really interesting thing, and it speaks to understanding how the vaccine works. When they did these trials, you had people who basically, within the tens of thousands of people, they raised their hand if they got sick, and then they were tested. And what they found was that this vaccine was really good, 95% effective, at keeping people from getting sick, which is great. What they don't know is how effective it is at keeping people from getting infected. And they don't know how well the vaccine works at keeping people from transmitting the virus. So important that it keeps people from getting sick, but you could still carry the virus. You could still transmit the virus even after being vaccinated. That's why you still got to wear a mask. Ultimately, we'll get to enough people who won't get sick that maybe we can start to gradually sort of lower our defenses. But that's why we have to do it for now.
Thank you very much. I love this conversation. I'm very grateful to you.
What an honor.
Don't forget the book, Keep Sharp. And goodbye, Sanjay. Good luck.
Goodbye, Mr. President. Thank you.
Why Am I Telling You This is a production of iHeartRadio, the Clinton Foundation, and At Will Media. Our executive producers are Craig Manassian and Will Malnati. Our production team includes Mitch Bluestein, Jameson Katsoufis, Tom Galton, Sarah Horowitz, and Jake Young, with production support from Tyler Scott and Latavia Young. Original music by Watt White. Special thanks to John Sykes, Tina Flannoy, John Davidson, Angel Urena, Corey Gansley, Oscar Flores, Kevin Thurm, and all our dedicated staff and partners at the Clinton Foundation. If you have an idea or suggestion for the show, we'd love to hear from you. So please visit clintonfoundation.org/podcast to share your thoughts with us. If you like the show, tell someone else about it. You can subscribe to Why Am I Telling You This on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. By listening to this podcast, you're helping support the work of the Clinton Foundation. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Street, Executive Director of the Clinton Foundation, where we work every single day to advance President Clinton's commitment to public service and improve lives across the country and around the world. President Clinton often reminds us that we're all in this together, that we rise or fall together. That's why, in the face of crisis, we answer the call. We act. At the Clinton Presidential Center, we've been proud to work together with partners to serve hundreds of thousands of meals to those struggling to put food on the table, to get books, early learning, and educational resources into the hands of parents, families, and educators who are navigating the realities of remote learning and need it most. And the center continues to serve as an educational and cultural institution focused on cultivating the next generation of leaders to make our future brighter than ever. Learn more about this work and see how you can get involved. Visit www.clintonfoundation.org/podcast.